Welcome to The Contrarians, where we are right and you are wrong. I'm Julio.
And I'm Alex. Here on the show, we rage against the Rotten Tomatoes machine. For the first half of each episode, Contrarians Corner, we trash the fresh red tomatoes and praise the rotten green splotches, making our case any way we can.
The aptly titled Real Talk serves as the second half of each episode. This is where we discuss our true feelings on the movie we're covering. For more information on our podcast and to browse past episodes, you can head over to our website, wearethecontrarians.com.
From there, you can also access our Patreon and merchandise, because capitalism.
If you enjoy our attempts at comedic film discussions, we encourage you to subscribe and leave us a review on whatever podcatcher you use.
If you'd like to reach out to us directly, that's what social media is for. You can find us on most platforms as @ContrarianPrime.
You can also see what we look like if you go to youtube.com/@ContrarianPrime, and you can contact us by email at wearethecontrarians@gmail.com.
I think that covers it.
Then it's time for the podcast. And we are recording for Contrarians Corner for Hereditary.
Julio, get your head back in the car. Come on. There's a telephone pole coming up. Can't you see it? Do you have any bad allergies that I don't know about?
Not as bad as this one. I mean, imagine being allergic to telephone poles. That would just be brutal.
Oh, shit. That really caught me off guard. I mean, to be fair, nut allergies are supposed to be the absolute worst. There's that episode of Freaks and Geeks where Squints puts like a peanut in something that Martin Starr eats and he has to go to the emergency room. But fortunately, his head stays intact. So
they don't drive him to the emergency room. They walk him carefully to the hospital.
Yeah. So no allergies. Julio and I know most things about each other. That when we were out of town on his bachelor party, like men do, we all got in a hot tub together. And I just remember being in awe of how manly Julio is with his mane of chest hair. That was like the last time I learned something big about him.
I had no idea that had been a revelation. I thought that my hairiness was just well known amongst the people surrounding us that day, but I guess not.
Well, fortunately on that trip, your head stayed intact. We learned today that no allergies. We're here, I guess, at long last, as we have taken pot shots at this movie over the years. I guess it's only proper Hereditary finally gets the full Contrarians treatment.
Yeah, for a filmmaker whose movies haven't really been discussed on the show, we really take the
piss out of them.
Yeah, like Ari Aster would be like, what's these guys' problem?
What's your problem, man?
We're about to tell you.
I have not crossed into Beau's Afraid, but his freshman and sophomore efforts, Hereditary and Midsommar, certainly get their fair share of strays from the Contrarians. So here today, 90% on Rotten Tomatoes, Hereditary starring Toni Collette. Julio, you texted me. This is her fourth appearance in Contrarians lore, and I, for the life of me, couldn't put the others together. I know, of course, Little Miss Sunshine, because we're extremely complimentary of her in that, but we've done a lot of episodes. We just crossed our 200th, so you'll forgive me if some of these evade me mentally. What else has she been in?
Well, I'll tell you this, Alex. Every movie of hers that we've done, including this one, has been fresh. Fresh, in a way. So we did The Sixth Sense.
Ah, yes. Academy Award nomination for that.
And we also did Knives Out.
I forgot about Knives Out, which is topical because M. Emmett Walsh, famous character actor from Blade Runner, amongst other things.
Christmas with the Cranks.
Yes, he passed away earlier today. In that category of Burt Young, of actors don't look like that anymore and we're worse off for it. Now, no disrespect to Burt Young or Mr. Walsh, but Toni Collette.
A little easier on the eyes.
I was about to say, a great actress and also, for my tastes in the opposite sex, a very attractive woman. Maybe not, you know, exuding sexuality in this movie quite as much as some of the others we've watched. But
dude, real talk, even at her worst, I was like, you know, and by that I mean even at her most like defeated and pummeled by life as she is in this movie, I was like, man, I'll give her a hug.
Julio, I'll just make, you know, it better. The severed head on the ground, he's just looking over.
Well,
Fuck. It seems proper that we finally do this, like I said, for these movies that we always give shit about. Hereditary, written and directed by Ari Aster. As I mentioned, this was his first time at bat as a feature film director. And boy, did this one do a lot for a lot of people. I remember the hype around this being quite notable. And A24 was already established by this point for what the, you know, that studio offered. But this kind of was, I think if you polled most people that would know what the fuck we're talking about, don't you feel like this would be like an A24 Mount Rushmore entry? Like a lot of people, not saying you or I, but a lot of people would have it on there.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly this one and The Lighthouse, I think, Alex, which we've also done on the show. I like that term, Mount Rushmore, A24 movies.
That's another one. Just off the top of my head here, and leave yours in the comments. Hereditary, Lighthouse, Spring Breakers, Uncut Gems. I think that would fly with most people, don't you think?
Yes, except I think Uncut Gems is split. I think that some people will just go to it because it's an Adam Sandler movie. Like Sandler, yes, is bigger than A24.
Well,
for better and for worse.
Good Time is a better movie than Uncut Gems, but that's a different discussion for a different day.
Yes.
Toni Collette, Alex Wolff, who was in something I watched recently.
Pig. You're probably known from Pig.
Pig is awesome. Oh, duh. He's an Oppenheimer. That's what I recognize him from. Miley Shapiro. M-I-L-L-Y. Let's go with Millie. Millie Shapiro. The younger sister, of course, of controversial radio host Ben Shapiro. That's not
There's
true.
There's no way. As if I didn't feel bad enough for that girl, for everything that she goes through in this movie.
Ann Dowd, perennial that girl, Ann Dowd, who's been around since my childhood, man.
Like I said last time Ann Dowd showed up, I said The Leftovers, Ann Dowd.
Well, for me, it's Bushwhacked, which I think I retorted with that same thing in yep. that she is the scoutmaster and lets them unbeknowingly get kidnapped by a grown man played by Daniel Stern, because God damn it, movies used to be movies. and then, of course, Gabriel Byrne rounding out the cast of this.
Man, Gabriel Byrne. And I mean, we'll discuss his performance and his character at length here, but it feels like it was yesterday that he was seducing Winona Ryder in Little Women when we covered Little Women on the main feed. And also yesterday when he was having a threesome with two women half his age on End of Days, where he played the devil himself.
You know, it'd be that way sometimes.
you blink and then you find yourself in an A24 movie where you're emasculated every second you're on the screen.
Life comes at you fast, man.
I said, stop right now.
Fine.
Premiered at Sundance on January 21st of 2018 for a wider release on June 8th of the same year. So a bit of a delay, bit of time to let the stew boil for a while, you know, and simmer and let the word get out. Budget of $10 million, box office return of over 80. And as we mentioned, man, this is you get into the wrong circles. People will be talking to you about this movie for, you know, you'll be trying really hard. You have a wife, so you could do the thing like the sign of like, hey, go over there, then act like you need me. I would just be like, I would have to say something to make the conversation end. 90% on Rotten Tomatoes, Julio. So what reviews did you pull for us?
A lot of fresh red tomatoes. We're going to start with Patrick Kavanaugh from The Wolfman Cometh, who says, a complete assault on your mind, body, and soul that will leave you feeling battered and broken. A good time at the movies, Alex.
Yes, if you have never seen a movie once before in your life, it'll do that.
Yes, but also, let's travel back in time to our Texas Chainsaw Massacre discussion. Just to think, that's the one that I always go to because it was just so memorable. And I felt so strongly, in a way, the way that Patrick Kavanaugh talks about Hereditary, where he's like, oh, it'll leave you feeling battered and broken. And that's how I was after watching the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I was like, God, why would anybody put themselves through this? And with Hereditary, it's like the same question, but with like 10 question marks at the end. I don't get it.
Yeah, if Texas Chainsaw maybe looked pretty, or I still don't.
If Toni Collette played Leatherface?
No, if they had done something like, you know, the dad, the cook, you know, maybe if he had depression But it was like he referred to it as his chainsaw, and then we see his son have an actual chainsaw, and you know that's his implement of expressing himself. The audience would have been like, "Oh, this is so deep. I've never seen a living metaphor before. Oh my God."
Toby Hooper would have gone on to have a very different career.
Toby Hooper, that's the type of thing you'd pitch him and be like, "Get the fuck off my movie set."
Security.
That's that David Lynch thing, the face he made when someone told him to cut the scene down. He's like, "What the fuck is your problem? Who gives a shit?"
All right, next. Jeffrey Zhang from Strange Harbors says, "Hereditary is a pitch black exploration of family dynamics and the fallout of dark supernatural secrets."
Oh my God, is anyone else falling asleep?
I just love that he puts the two things on the same level. Like an exploration of family dynamics, which is something that happens in real life, and that dark supernatural secrets.
I mean, who among us haven't, you know, in one weekend encountered both things?
Every single person that goes to the attic after not having gone there for a couple of years, you know, you're going to find a bunch of flies and a corpse or two.
A decapitated corpse of one of your parents up there.
Next, Matthew Sinclair from Cinema Centuries says, "It shouldn't be a huge surprise to see Toni Collette give a great performance. However, the things she does here are unlike anything else that she's ever done in her career."
All right.
There's a reason for that, maybe.
She hasn't self-decapitated on screen, I guess, but
no. She's been trying to get a self-decapitation in her movies for decades.
Been trying to pitch it, but no one just went for it.
Yeah, Ari Aster, first-time director, got bullied into it.
It was the A24 said this or we're pulling your funding.
You let her do whatever she wants. All right, now we're going to close with Damon Fudge. Man, what a name.
That is good.
They say, "Not only is Hereditary the slowest of slow burns this side of Michael Mann film, it is also a near masterpiece of horror filmmaking." Like, quite a big name drop there. Michael Mann. Can you imagine Michael Mann's Hereditary?
Might be a little flashier.
I've never seen a Michael Mann horror movie, so.
No.
I mean, he does make slow movies and usually long movies, but...
We talked about Ali extensively on here before.
Yeah, but Ali kind of like holds together in a way that I think Hereditary
Well, and I also don't really know what he's trying to, like, you know, Michael Mann made Heat. And while that's a long movie, there's a lot going on in that, a lot more than this shit.
Yeah, but Alex, Ari Aster has made Bo is Afraid or Bo Can't Sleep, whatever it is. We haven't seen it. Maybe that's his Heat.
No, thank you. It could be, but life's too short, you know?
Life's too short, and his movies keep getting longer, so not a good equation.
And yeah, I take umbrage with that review, and that's, I'm not going to go too far into this because that's real talk. So go back to where I started. If you've never seen a movie before in your entire life, all of the things you just said are true. Now, to Hereditary.
My mother was a very secretive and private woman. She had private rituals, private friends, private anxieties.
It is an A24 movie, as I mentioned. The movie starts with an obituary that we
classic
learn is
A24.
Yes, that we learn is for Toni Collette's mom, Ellen. Yeah, man, that's Spring Breakers. That thing started with just heavy house music, young, good-looking people dancing and shit. That was like the bursting open the barn doors for A24. And now it's just all fucking dreary and muted
gloom
tones
and doom,
death. Yeah, exactly. And we get like a long panning shot of these doll houses, and what we learn is that a miniature artist, Annie Graham, lives with her psychiatrist husband Steve, their 16-year-old son Peter, and 13-year-old daughter Charlie. The family attends the funeral of Annie's secretive mother, Ellen, at which Annie is surprised at the number of mourners in attendance. She attends a bereavement support group, revealing her troubled childhood and that she and her mother had a fraught relationship until Charlie was born, when Ellen became a significant figure in raising her. Meanwhile, Steve receives a phone call telling him that unknown perpetrators desecrated Ellen's gravesite, but does not reveal this to Annie. So we're doing our new adopted method of to help me stay on track a little bit better of recounting the plot this way. So I understand I just went through a lot there. But Toni Collette, as an artist here that forms scenes with miniatures, I mean,
clearly Gabriel Byrne is the one that's paying the bills in this household.
And it took me about 30 seconds to go, oh, we're going to start to see scenes that are depicting what is happening in the movie or that happened previously to give us like context into shit. And one of them that's fucked up as hell is that Charlie's grandmother was breastfeeding her when she was an infant because she took over on such a maternal level. That one I was like, whoa, dude. Whoa, brother.
That defies biology, right?
I would think so.
Right? I mean, you have to. Actually, I don't know. I just felt myself walking up to the edge of saying something that I have no idea about. I don't know anything about pregnancy. So,
hell yeah, brother. Two dudes talking about women's bodies. We're really Texans after all.
Yes. Well, I thought you were going to reference the fact that there's a miniature of Toni Collette and Gabriel Byrne going to town on each other.
Yeah, I was kind of sad we didn't get the actual portrayal of that.
Man, Gabriel Byrne doesn't look like he has the energy to do anything in this movie.
This is very true, especially act.
He just shuffled into set, recited his lines because he's a damn professional and he had memorized them, and then he shuffled away.
At the support group, Toni Collette finally like shares. She goes in. She's like Carmi on The Bear. It takes her a while to really get to the point of sharing, but when she does, it's just open the floodgates, man. You know, it's not going to stop it. Julio, what all does she divulge about her life to us, the audience?
Everything. She's like, I was born in, and it just goes on like the spotlight falls on her, and then she gets up. It's like on a chorus line right before one of the characters goes into their song.
Not much to tell, really. Just a small town girl.
She had a very, I guess, strained relationship with her mom, as you said. And there is, the timeline is confusing to me because she said that her mom has started losing her mind, like losing her sanity. But then they became closer again when her first kid was born, when Charlie was born, and the mom moved in to live with them. At what point does the breastfeeding of Charlie happen? Was that before her mom lost her mind? Because that already seems like it would have been too much.
The milk's gone sour at that point.
It's a lot. It's a lot. And my heart went out to all those people in the support group who clearly were not ready for somebody to overshare to that extent. I mean, that's her first night in this group. She just wandered in and she was a new person. Usually all you do is like, hi, my name is, and then you sit down. But
she stripped down and cannonballed into the water. She didn't check the temperature at all.
There's a couple of cuts to reactions from people there, and they all seem pretty horrified.
We learn repeatedly that she hates her son. So,
and honestly, after spending 2 hours with Alex Wolff in this movie, I'm on her side. That kid's annoying as all hell. But yeah, it's funny. It shouldn't be, but it is, right? There is a fine line when you have a character just unleash all this unleash this tale of misery. It's like compounded. You know, those of you who are patrons, you listen to our Iron Claw episode over there and how I talked about it. It felt like it was, even for a movie that was like almost 2.5 hours, there was a point where it felt like the tragedy was too much. And that's over 2 hours and 20 minutes or so. This is Toni Collette like condensing all that tragedy in a 5-minute monologue.
I was going to make the joke of like, this is like if Kevin Von Erich went to a support group and told the whole story in 5 minutes to everybody.
Exactly.
And then he's like, and the worst part is I had a brother, Chris, who killed himself and he wasn't even in the fucking movie. It's fitting you use the word like, or I don't know if you use the word comical, but you did say it was like almost humorous to a point, because in my notes here, in the opening stanza of this movie, I have the phrase in my notes, this is comically brooding, because it is like, dude, the opening of this movie is like a trailer from like before Tropic Thunder, you know, one of the, which I know that's a really easy go to because everyone's been talking about that since the Oscars, but it really, it does feel like that. It's like, okay. Jason Takes Manhattan starts a bit more subtle than this thing. And it is just, we see like ominous shots of the little girl walking, and there's just those subdural tones throughout it, and just boom, 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 boom. That shit is fucking annoying, man. And that's what I was talking about. All these people who are horror experts all of a sudden when this thing came out, the simplicity of it. Like it, the greatest horror theme in history, John Carpenter made on his bongos. And here it's like just overthinking things to the max.
But just so you don't get bored with all the talking, don't worry, because Toni Collette's daughter is going to decapitate a bird.
Yes.
Just for fun.
A la Amy's mother on Everyone Loves Raymond. Took it out of its misery.
Can you come back from that as a character? That was my instant thought. Like, man, that's it. Once you see the little girl clip that bird's head off.
It's around this point in the movie, too, that I saw they had a dog. And because I know what kind of movie this is, I'm like, this dog's going to die. So I was like already pissed off. And you know what? The dog dies. And I was pissed off.
Yeah. I mean, they make you wait all the way to the end. You know, they're like, they know that that's the character you care about the most. So.
And yeah, exactly. And it's artsy, so it's okay.
What do you make of Charlie's trademark sound? Yeah.
Do you want to know what I was really thinking about? I couldn't stop thinking about that scene in The Social Network where they're in that pitch meeting and Jesse Eisenberg keeps doing that. And do you know what I'm talking about? Because it's when him and Andrew Garfield are like trying to get funding for it. And Mark's just so aloof. It's during like that montage where Eduardo's trying to do everything but bring in Sean Parker, and Jesse Eisenberg doesn't want to do anything, but yeah. And they're in a meeting and he just keeps going. And that guy's like, what is he doing? And that's kind of what I felt like here with Charlie. I'm like, come on, do something else.
Eduardo's like, he just watched this fucking movie, Hereditary.
Like she could at least howl at the moon or some shit.
She might have if the movie had let her live past the first act.
Who's to say, really? Peter, his 16-year-old, of course, is invited to a party, to which Annie insists that Charlie go with him. At the party, Peter leaves Charlie unattended, where she eats a cake containing walnuts, which triggers her severe nut allergy. All right, so we learn she has a nut allergy in the like opening stanza of this movie at the funeral, because she's eating like a Snickers or Crunch Bar or something. Like, are there peanuts in that? There can't be peanuts in it. To which I said, okay, she's going to eat peanuts at some point. And when they walk into this party, it cuts. I'm not kidding you. It like Rob Zombie watches this and he goes like, Jesus, let's tone it back a notch. Like they immediately cut to these girls chopping up walnuts and then like then pan to Charlie like, ooh. Like I said, not to make light of anyone with a nut allergy. I know those things are fucking deadly, but it's just this movie is not subtle.
Just as deadly. The first draft of this scene had a guy dressed as Mr. Peanut just dancing in the background, just in case you didn't get it. This was a dangerous environment.
No, they had to make it a bit more artistic. So like when they got to the party, there was a guy, it was like an old bald man with a monocle, top hat and a cane wearing a suit that like was glaring at Charlie. And then when she shook, what's his name, Peter, and was like, look, when she looked back, he was gone. That would have been like the peanut allergy is haunting her.
But too many people got confused with the Monopoly guy. So like, no, scrap it. We're just going to have girls chopping walnuts.
Peter shows up too to this party packing some what appears to be pretty good weed. I remember the weed I would have bought when I was 16 was pencil shavings pretty much. So wherever they're living, he must have a good hookup.
We never see his dealer. That's actually an excellent point, Alex, because this kid is so socially awkward and so he seems pretty sheltered, all things considered, right? Like maybe it's just the problem with the movie is that we never see his social life under normal circumstances. So all we've seen him is right after his grandma dies. And then shortly,
he apparently likes this girl at the party, but we've spent no time on it. It's just, again, just all these static shots that were just supposed to like, oh, mental health, it's hereditary. And then when they want us to actually care about these characters, like the things that are important to them mean nothing to us.
Yeah. I think can you imagine if they actually spent the first 30 minutes of the movie really getting us
being good
to know. Yeah, well, being good by getting us to know Alex Wolff so that when things go bad for him, you actually care instead of just going, well, you had it coming. You're a dumbass. And to be fair, everybody in this family is just terrible. Charlie, you're not off the hook. At 13, you should know what kills you. I mean, that is, she's not, if she was a preteen, I would buy it, right? Like when you're like 10 up to 11, maybe you still don't take death seriously. But at 13, there is no way that she's not aware of, like hyper aware of nuts and what could happen to her if she happens to eat one. So that's on her. Toni Collette, terrible parenting.
Okay. Yes. Look, 13-year-olds going to like senior and high school parties. What the fuck are you doing as a parent, man?
Exactly. And the thing is, neither of the kids wanted this to happen. It's not that Charlie wanted to go to the party, so Toni Collette decided to help her out. And it's not like Peter wanted his little sister at this party to help him be social. So, no, it's just force your two kids into an awkward situation that neither of them wanted to be part of. That's terrible. And then Peter, come on, dude. You know that nuts could kill your sister. And you just let her roam around. Didn't you see the girls cutting the walnuts when you first walked
even
in?
More dangerous, like a bunch of upperclassmen around your little sister. It's just it all falls apart at the seams. And I've been in situations like that before where not necessarily at that age, but like when my sister would come to visit me in college and we would go out, I would understand that I have to like take it back a notch because I'm looking out for my sister and shit. And it's just dumb fuckers all the way around, man.
You didn't just disappear into a room with your bag of weed?
No. I couldn't smoke and go to class either. I know people did that when I went to high school, and that's obviously on display in this movie. And I'm sure someone listening to this right now would get stoned in between classes in high school and go to class. I could never do that, not even in college. Like in college, sometimes maybe I'd go on break and have a beer or two before my next class. But like, man, that's a skill set I never acquired.
You would pay for it later. You'd find yourself slamming your face on your desk.
I would be tired, you know, I'd need like a bit of a nap, but anyway, into the intelligence level here, our main character, Toni Collette, Annie, before too long, doesn't realize that she's fucking entering into a cult. There's writing on the wall everywhere, man. And writing to the hospital is Peter as he takes Charlie after she goes into anaphylactic shock. He tells her to get some fresh air and she leans out the window. When Peter swerves to avoid hitting a dead deer lying in the road, she is accidentally decapitated by a telephone pole. In shock, Peter drives home and leaves Charlie's headless body in the back seat of his parents' car, which Annie discovers to her horror the following morning. This scene I cannot speak to as one way or the other because trying to put myself, that wouldn't happen, but like in, because my sister doesn't have a nut allergy, but just trying to be a bit empathetic here. I cannot imagine what that would be like or the shock that would bring on. So this is the only part of the movie where I'm like, who's to say what you do in that situation?
Okay. But wouldn't you call 911? Where is this taking place that 911 is not anybody's, you know, because he wasn't by himself at that party. There was, I don't know, 20, 30 people there, at least one person should have said, hey, let me call 911. How about you don't drive in this state?
All right. So it's in Utah.
Oh, never mind.
Where weed is the death penalty. So he probably made the right call, at least trying to get her to the hospital.
Okay. Well, let's give Peter a pass on this one. I'm not going to give Ari Aster a pass.
As you should not.
Because it's the easy way out to just stay with Peter. Is just a close-up of Alex Wolff through the entire sequence after she loses her head. I want the shots of Toni Collette opening the car door and finding the headless body. I mean,
well, it shows the kid's head. It's like the clickbait shot. That's what everyone remembers from this movie.
You will not believe what happened next.
You will not believe what caused this. You know, that type of thing.
Yeah, but I want you have Toni Collette in your movie. Actually, you know what? I don't need the Toni Collette reaction. I mean, I would like it. I want the Gabriel Byrne reaction. Like, I want to see him come alive when he sees his headless daughter. Like, that will jolt him, hopefully.
Toni Collette does discover, unfortunately, the headless body of her little girl. She screams. She's in unfathomable pain while Peter just lies emotionless in his bed. We then cut to, as I mentioned, the clickbait shot of Miley Shapiro's decapitated head covered in ants. Completely unnecessary. Adds nothing. That's the thing. If Toni Collette had discovered that, that adds something. But just showing it like it's a fucking loading screen in a video game, it's just like, all right, what are we doing here?
It's also, you know, that's how you shoot a comedy, right? Because that's it's the shot of when you finally get to see Ben Stiller's crotch and There's Something About Mary after he zipped it up. Right. Like there's about 5 minutes of teasing you and you're like, there's no way that they're going to show us. And then they finally go for that close up and then you laugh because you've been anticipating that. In this case, I don't know if anybody was anticipating seeing Millie Shapiro's head on the ground covered in ants. Right. You didn't. And like you said, it serves no purpose unless you want us to laugh at it. And I know. So it's just shock value. And I don't care for that. I do wonder what happened to that head, like the prop, much like with the Pam Grier head from Ghosts of Mars. Like who ended up with the Millie Shapiro head in their display at home? Because Millie Shapiro, she's too young for her to have that, right? She didn't get it.
Yeah.
Toni Collette? You think Toni Collette took it?
Ari Aster probably has it on his mantle. It's like, this is my rosebud.
This is how it started.
My daughter was killed.
Oh, I'm so, so sorry. Oh, would you like to come in with me?
The family is fractured following Charlie's funeral. Peter becomes reclusive and racked with guilt over his sister's death. Annie becomes bitter and resentful towards Peter for his involvement in the accident. And Steve tries to mediate peace between them. Annie befriends a support group member named Joan. This is Ann Dowd. In my notes, it says, hey, that lady, who teaches Annie to perform a seance to communicate with Charlie's ghost. Later that night, Annie convinces her family to attempt the seance. Objects begin to move and smash, and Peter is terrified when Annie is possessed and speaks in Charlie's voice until Steve throws water on her. As Peter begins to be haunted by supernatural forces, Annie suspects Charlie's spirit has become vengeful and demonic. When she sees images manifesting in Charlie's sketchbook threatening Peter, she throws the book into the fireplace. However, her clothing goes up in flames at the same time the book does. Her clothes only stop burning when she pulls the book from the flames. So, this friendship with Joan. First thing, she goes to her apartment, has the same welcome mat as her mom, and her mom made those welcome mats. Doesn't think much of it.
It's not time yet.
And it's during this sequence of the movie that we learn of the original attempted manslaughter of Peter, in which what the story was, Annie claimed she was sleepwalking and doused him with paint thinner, right? Was going to set him on fire.
Yeah, she was going to set him on fire. And then she woke up. She was, oh, just kidding. But surprisingly, they've never gotten over that. Gabriel Byrne never looked at her the same way. I can just imagine the people of that support group. They see Toni Collette driving up, parking. They're like, fuck this. And they get out. Don't have time for this lady's stories anymore.
They just turn around and leave. Not today. No. I forgot. I left something at home. I forgot something.
Ann Dowd, surprisingly friendly, just overly friendly with this stranger. And she has her own tale of sadness and loss. She lost her son, right?
Yes, grandson.
Grandson, yeah.
Because that's who she is talking to through the seance. And again, Toni Collette, I understand she's in a really fucked up headspace because everything going on, but this is where you kind of have to check yourself. If I think you're playing with some evil forces at hand here.
She'd never seen The Exorcist. That's how it starts. That's how Pazuzu gets you.
A lot of people who saw this never saw The Exorcist.
You know who did? Ari Aster.
Yes. And he convinced himself no one else ever had.
yeah, the whole exorcism part of the story, or rather, you know, the development of the exorcism or the seance, you know, it's not a Ouija board, but she teaches her how to move the cup. I guess it's a homemade Ouija board, right? Where she has a little glass, the shot glass. And this is when the movie starts abandoning reality for sure. Like up till now, we're like an hour in. It's like the halfway point. It was all grounded. You know, Toni Collette was having a really fucked up time, but she was relatable in a way, right? Like it was all things like, well, you know, lost her mom, lost her daughter almost back to back. It makes sense. But then once we get to the supernatural stuff, it starts feeling extra silly.
Yes.
Did you feel that turn, Alex, when she calls him over?
This is Contrarian's Corner, real talk, all balled into one here. There's something to this movie, but when it just becomes another fucking cult possession movie, I'm like, all right. This is the point in my notes where in all caps it says, move this along.
My note just says, like, poor Toni Collette. A respectable actress suddenly finds herself talking like a child.
Yes, but it's also during this part of the film that she does get her Oscar clip, the dinner scene.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So this is before it gets supernatural. And this is my note for that says poor Gabriel Byrne, because he just disappears into the background. It's Toni Collette's world. Everybody else is just living in it.
So there's a big dinner scene a la Family Stone. We'll reference The Bear again, you know, any of the great dramas out there, the contentious dinner scene. American Beauty, thank you. Home for the Holidays. No, the ice storm. We'll be here all night. But she just snaps and just cuts a scathing promo on her son about, I know, don't fucking look at me like that. I know you hate me. Yeah.
Okay, I mean, legit, Alex, wasn't she just expressing your inner feelings? Because she was expressing mine. I was like, snap the fuck out of it, Alex Wolf. Own up to the fact that you killed your sister.
Sadly, during this, I couldn't help myself from laughing because there's a SNL skit from several years ago, probably the better part of 15 years ago now, when Zac Efron hosted. And the premise of the skit was it was Zac Efron and Andy Samberg, and they were like, you know, on the high school soccer team or something. And they were coming back from practice, and the commercial was going to be that the mom, Zac Efron's mom, put a plate of pizza rolls on the kitchen counter and they like scarf them down. And like the punchline of the commercial is Zac Efron says, they're a lot better than what she cooks, like as a joke, and everyone's supposed to laugh. And Fred Armisen plays the mom. And the line he's supposed to have is, hey, I'm your mother. And everyone laughs. And the skit is just him not understanding the tone of the commercial and delivering it so viciously repeatedly that to the point where he goes, I am your mother. And that's exactly what I kept thinking about during the sequence, because Toni Collette says, I'm your mother at one point. And yeah, that's the most serious part of the movie and the best acted part of the movie. I still found myself thinking about something else because I was bored.
It's her Oscar clip, and it's the opposite of an Oscar clip for Gabriel Byrne, because as I referenced, he's just, what happened, Alex? Was his sugar low?
It's his golden raspberry clip.
But not even, because I think that you have to be doing something in order to get nominated for a Razzie. He's just sitting there, kind of like mumbling, can I get a word in?
Fair point. The Razzies are for like bad performances. This is just like nothing.
It's a non-performance.
Yes. It's as hollow as this movie.
Maybe Gabriel Byrne was the only one who realized this was bullshit. Just get me out of here. All right. So it's okay. So you're right. This is the end. This is how we close the door on reality. And from here on, now it's just going to be supernatural shenanigans.
And Anne Dowd is everywhere. I don't know how big the town they live in is, but like she's everywhere.
She's like Michael Myers, just looking from across the street.
Exactly. To the point where a normal person would start to wonder, like, is this woman following me? But not Toni Collette.
But Toni Collette she's a miniature show to prepare for.
This is true. The coordinator or the owner of the museum keeps calling, or is her agent or something, and she's just falling behind. She tries to make like a model of the crime scene that her daughter died in, and Gabriel Byrne excoriates her for it.
Well, That's too strong a word for what Gabriel Byrne does. He just shakes his finger, hey, and then he goes to sleep on the couch.
Jesus Christ, Danny. You're not planning on letting him see that, are you?
Annie goes through her mother's old belongings and finds a photo album that shows Ellen to have been Queen Lee, the leader of a coven, and Joan was one of her acolytes. My note says, ah, cult shit. another book describes the demon king Paimon, who wishes to inhabit the body of a male host. The summoner of Paimon will receive wealth and rewards. In the attic, Annie finds Ellen's rotting, decapitated body and occultist runes drawn in blood. So we're
so far from where we started.
Dude, no shit. The premise of this movie is fucking The Curse of Michael Myers, Halloween 6. Like, you know, we start just as a normal Halloween movie, and then before you know it, it's like, whoa, 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 what are we doing?
She goes into the attic and she... No, it's not the attic. It's somewhere else because she hasn't gone to the attic
yet. That rotting body's been in there for weeks and it hasn't stunk up their house. I question the ventilation system that they have.
They have a great ventilation. No, they have a terrible ventilation system, I guess. No, but she finds that the treasure cove of exposition. It's just jackpot. This is going to explain the movie. It is nonstop weird stuff. And I don't know about you, but I didn't get all that from seeing the pictures and whatever. I didn't know that her mom was the queen bee or whatever. That's until the very end. At the very end, there's a picture that has her title, but I just thought it was pictures of her mom hanging out with her friends. That's still pretty incriminating because Anne Dowd obviously knew her mom and didn't say anything. So that's weird, but it really felt like if this is the movie you were making, then maybe you should have parse this information throughout the movie instead of having this one scene where Toni Collette just discovers the backstory all at once.
This scene is not that far from her just turning and looking into the camera and be like, oh my God, she was in a cult.
Did you catch when, because you know, there's close-ups of the books and whatever. Did you bother to read what the book was saying? And did that give you a feeling of where the movie was headed? Because, you know, it says like the demon, whatever, the demon trickster prefers a male body.
I had an idea of where it was going, and I didn't expect the ending to pretty much be the ending of Lords of Salem, but I thought it was going to go in that direction. Or I don't know, maybe I had a little more hope that good would prevail. Because I knew the shocking scene at the end. I already knew about that. That was like the one thing that was spoiled for me from this. But so yes and no. I thought I had an idea of where it was going, but I also had an idea of where I didn't want it to go. And that's where it went. What about you? The first time you saw this movie, like, were you just like, did you kind of do one of those ugh, when this all was revealed?
I wish I could remember at what point I gave up on the hope that we were witnessing Toni Collette's very real descent into madness and that she was just confusing. You know, it was like she was Black Swan. Mm-hmm. She was confusing reality with just all the stuff that was going on in her head because she was trying to make sense of something that doesn't make sense, you know, unspeakable tragedies and so on. And I wish I could remember because I watched this in theaters. And so there was no hype. There was no anything. I just watched it back row blind. And so I just wish I could remember. I just know that at some point I had to come to terms with what was really happening, which was, oh no, Ari Aster, he is not interested in real life at all. But at this point, I want to say I was probably still thinking, oh no, she's just, you know, she's going through her mom's belongings and Anne Dowd probably doesn't even exist. It's just some voice in her head and this is going to be revealed in the climax, which wouldn't have been a good movie, but it would have been a better movie, I think, than what we ended up getting.
While Peter is outside his school, Joan appears and attempts to expel his spirit from his body for the Demon King. In class, Peter is taken over by an unseen force and slams his head into his desk, breaking his nose. Annie informs Steve of her ties to Charlie's sketchbook and begs him to burn it, as she cannot bring herself to take her own life. When he refuses, Believing Annie has gone insane, she snatches the book from him and flings it into the fire, only for Steve to burst into flames instead. And it's like a comical amount of fire. It's like that. Maybe it was the pilot of Jackass, one of the first ones where Knoxville set himself on fire, like that. It was to that level of comedy. Freddy versus Jason, when Jason is coming through the cornfields completely ablaze. It's like that level of comedic fire.
Oh, see, I was thinking of the opening of Clerks 2 because the fire looks so fake. Gabriel Byrne, obviously, he's never been set on fire in his entire life, so he just doesn't know how to react to it. But then the special effects don't help him either. It just looks like it's superimposed, because that's what the opening of Clerks 2. And if you guys haven't seen it, I'm sure it's on YouTube. The difference is Kevin Smith was probably working with a fraction of the budget for this movie. But it's just, he opens the door of the Quick Mart or whatever, and there's just these really fake flames. Just, oh yeah, I believe you, the building's on fire. And that was my same reaction here. Okay, I guess Gabriel Byrne is burning himself. He went from burn to burned.
Ayo, that was slick. I need my Letterman note card to pound on the desk after that one. This is when naked people begin to appear too, because there's one back in the corner when Annie watches all this happen. Annie watches in horror, but her expression grows blank as she is taken over by the same force that possessed Peter earlier. So now it's Jason goes to hell. It's this fucking thing that's just jumping around.
Okay, but could you follow that? Could anyone follow that? And if you say yes on first watch, I call bullshit. There is no way that you're like, oh, yeah, first the kid was possessed and now she's possessed, because where was the transference? Like, you know, how did that happen?
So, Julio, you know why I could keep up with this?
Because you've seen horror movies before?
Because I've seen a movie in my life before. Because I've seen horror movies before specifically, yes.
It's my fault for treating this like a normal movie, not a horror movie, and thinking, no, there has to be, you know, more connective tissue.
I'd be more than fine treating it like a regular movie, but as the reviews you read stated repeatedly, and as all anyone wants to talk about this movie is elevated horror. It's a great horror film. Fuck off.
What is elevated horror? When you take a mediocre horror movie and cast really well-known actors.
That's the thing. Like, people, that's it. It means it has an A-list cast, because even the ideas, if you want to fuck around like that, then The Exorcist is elevated horror. Exorcist 3 is elevated horror. Could make an argument that the original Nightmare on Elm Street is elevated horror just for the subject that it deals with. That's the whole point. People don't know what it means. That interview, I think it was South by last year, someone asked Bruce Campbell about his thoughts on elevated horror. He's like, I don't know what that means. And John Carpenter had something really witty about the phrase elevated horror. I can't recall what it is, but in this elevated horror film, Julio, naked coven members begin to gather both inside and around the house. Peter wakes after dark and finds his father's charred corpse.
Doesn't smell it. You were concerned about the smell of the corpse in the attic. I was more concerned with the fact that there's a crispy Gabriel Byrne in the living room. And
the height of those flames, the house would have caught on fire.
They're supernatural. Especially flames, Alex.
An old wooden house like that, man, that would have gone up. Poof. It doesn't smell the corpse. He notices one of the coven members in a nearby doorway, a now possessed Annie, then chases him through the house. He attempts to hide in the attic. Annie follows him and then beheads herself with a piece of piano wire. This is like the famous thing the movie's known for. This is the thing I knew from the movie before seeing it for the first time.
And, you didn't know about Toni Collette on the ceiling, like Spider-Man?
Dancing on the Ceiling by Lionel Richie. Now that would have made me, that would have saved the whole movie if he started playing that song during the sequence. That would have been fantastic. Yeah, man. I talked about the first time I saw this, like that was what I knew was in it, because that was like all the rage. And okay. I appreciate to an extent the practicality of the effects and whatnot, but I don't know. I don't know if I should be proud or like ashamed of like how not desensitized I am, but it's just like I've spent 30 years watching horror movies So it takes something fairly substantial for me to go, oh, fuck. And, you know, I understand a lot of people that saw this hadn't been watching horror for 30 years and went, oh, fuck. But for me, I was just like, all right, that's cool.
Here's the problem for people like me who are not, you know, I don't know that I'm desensitized. I think that I don't care for different reasons. I don't care because I don't care. You know what I mean? Like, if I actually...
Oh, as far as the characters go at this point in the movie, too, like, that's what you sacrifice when you're trying to do elevated horror. And I just did really comedically exaggerated air quotes when I said that. You're trying to tell this really human story. In the process, you're executing all these really cliched and like played out horror tropes that make these human people seem really fucking stupid. And so by the end, it's just like, okay, I don't care. They all, yeah, they deserve to die for not like focusing on any of like the telltale signs of what's going on around them. So I don't know if that's why you don't care. It's just, by the end of the movie, I had no investment in these characters.
It's not even about the tropes, because I don't watch enough horror movies for the tropes to be that obstacle in, you know, the connection. Even though I could tell you that I recognize, you know, horror beats and whatever, but no, I think it's just in the construction of the movie. And you're right. I mean, it is, I think, part of the, when you're building up to these, you know, supposedly shocking scenes, the problem is that, yes, you have to sacrifice, I think, characterization, or at least the shocking things don't come from a character engine. They come from the fact that you just want to shock people. You know what I mean? Like, yes, the visual of Toni Collette decapitating herself, or Toni Collette like on the ceiling like Spider-Man, or Toni Collette banging her head against the attic door. Like, yes, visually is kind of jarring and it can provoke a reaction, but it's not something that's coming out of who she is as a character. If you're building up this as the story of a woman that's consumed by guilt and by confusion about grief and all this stuff, again, these actions, these things that happen at the end, don't say anything about that. Don't give me any insight, any sort of closure about her character. They're just there because, oh, well, you just want to show me something fucked up. And it applies to her. It applies to Alex Wolff. Like, the Alex Wolff character goes on some really weird journey. I don't know what that has to say about the fact that he accidentally killed his sister. The movie has zero interest in exploring that. Instead, it's just like, oh, well, but isn't it funny? Isn't it fucked up that he sees all these like naked people and they're worshiping him, and now he's the demon Pazuzu? So that's where really it loses me. You know, I don't care. I wouldn't care about how much it is like other horror movies if I give a shit about the characters, but I don't. You know, Gabriel Byrne, he's lovable, but he's like, I should feel something when he's set on fire. And I don't. I'm just like, man, that looks fake. That's my thought. When, going back to Clerks 2, when they opened that door and the store's on fire, and the movie was like 5 minutes in, but I was like, oh shit, the store is on fire, because I cared. Gabriel Byrne's on fire. I don't care. And I've been with that character for like an hour and a half by then.
Didn't see that one coming, to be honest with you. The Clerks 2 reference here. Yeah.
It's, look it up. You, Alex, listeners, if you are not familiar or don't remember, look up the beginning of Clerks 2 and then think of Gabriel Byrne on fire. And you're going to laugh.
Personally, I'm good, but listeners, go for it. All right. Peter jumps from the attic window, dying upon impact with the ground. A glowing orb enters and reanimates his body. Now displaying Charlie's mannerisms, he follows Annie's floating headless corpse into Charlie's treehouse. This is where in the background we see the dog's been killed because, of course, fuck this movie. Where Joan and other members of the coven, as well as the headless corpses of Peter's mother and grandmother, are worshiping a mannequin with Charlie's crowned, severed head placed on it. Joan removes the crown and places it on Peter's head. Addressing him as Charlie, she then proclaims that Peter's Paimon having corrected his female body and given him his preferred male host.
It's a lot to ask of Ann Dowd to try to explain the movie.
Dog, that's what it is. In the last 3 minutes of the movie, she explains the whole movie to the audience.
I think she's like, all right, I'll do it, but I'm not going to be on camera for this. She's just reading off the script as the camera focuses again on Alex Wolff's face.
It's a movie. And personal preference. Would you have preferred it just they crown him Paimon, or do you think that the heavy exposition adds anything to the closing stretch of the movie? If you're going to go for it, just go for it. Just do it and end your movie.
I agree. I think that, and look, we've heard enough tales of the industry. It wouldn't surprise me if that final monologue or that final bit of heavy exposition from Ann Dowd was added after test screenings where the audience was like, what the fuck happened? Maybe even added in post. Maybe that's why we don't see her, you know, because that was just, they brought her over to loop those lines. I think that if you decided that you don't care about people getting it, then just do that. Don't give me the Cliff's Notes at the end just to make sure everybody got it. No, because if you really wanted me to get it, then you would have given me the breadcrumbs. Also, I mean, fuck it. It's more effective, I think. You crown them, you crown him, and then cut to black credits, and people are like, maybe it's my fault.
This came up on our Patreon recently in our discussion of Poor Things. Bore Things.
Don't you fucking dare.
Okay, Poor Things is a better movie than this.
Thank you. But I don't have the energy to fight you over Poor Things right now after
we're not going there. Yeah, no, this is the closing thought before we go to real talk. I would so much rather a movie end and me go, what? Than in the last 10 minutes of the movie, I'm screaming at the screen. I get it. And this will be the second time this year that I can tell you about a movie we covered on The Contrarians. Just watch Lords of Salem instead.
The other one was Dunson Checks In.
All right. I don't know how much different Real Talk's going to be, Julio, but are we ready to jump on over? We got to hop in the car.
I apologize, listeners. I got fired up, and really a lot of that final stretch, I was just venting. That's right. I have more things to say. But yeah.
All right. Let's grab an EpiPen and head on over to Real Talk.
Let's do it.